This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
How are you being channeled? When humans are unhappy, they gather to protest or riot, perhaps. But now, especially during years of pandemic, many find their activism online. Meanwhile, governments, corporations, and tech-savvy individuals find new ways to block social dissent. Probably no one has studied repression more than professor and social scientist Jennifer Earle. Dr. Earle teaches and leads projects at the University of Arizona. She writes a lot of useful papers, and her book is Digitally Enabled Social Change. Jennifer is uniquely qualified to speak about online tools for activists and the relatively new subject of digital repression. From Tucson, Arizona, Jennifer Earle, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me, and thank you for that kind introduction.
Well, Jennifer, what stimulated you to engage in your life work on social expression and the mechanisms of control?
I've always been interested in how people try to create change, but I've also been interested in the law, which many people think about as a force for change, but as someone who grew up as the daughter of a lawyer, I realized could often be used to thwart change. And so at the same time that I've been interested in social movements, I've been interested in how state and private actors try to control and constrain protest, sometimes using legal tools and sometimes using extra legal tools. And in my discipline, that's referred to as the study of social movement repression.
And do you think online activism is a real thing, or are we kidding ourselves?
I absolutely do think it's a real thing. And I think that it introduces new models of power that have not been accessible before. And I actually think one of the places where people maybe go wrong in thinking about digital activism is that they think about it as a replacement as opposed to a broadening of a repertoire. If we have conventionally had to, for instance, rely on the media to promote and share social movement messages based on protests and social movement activity, people now have a chance to directly reach out to other people and try to publicize their views and beliefs, and also to use digital tools to organize, which may in some ways allow them to organize around broader range of issues and bring new types of people into activism. One of the things that I always like to point out about digital activism is that it also introduces a new model of power, which some have called flash activism, likening it to the power of a flash flood. So if our traditional model of the power of activism is something like the rising tide and erosive force of water flowing, just the constant pressure for change, one of the forms of power that digital activism can be very good at is something that's much more like a flash flood. It just brings so much attention and so much concern to an issue, albeit sometimes for a short period of time, but that short period of time can overwhelm systems and lead to change. And so I often encourage people to think about this is a broadening of a repertoire of protest as opposed to a substitution.
Well, just to get us rolling on your new study, could you give us a couple of examples of digital repression?
Certainly. So digital repression really refers to two different kinds of things, and both are important to understanding a broader repressive repertoire online. The first kind of thing it refers to is the targeting of individuals for repression based on their digital presence. And that targeting may be for traditional forms of repression like arrest. So, for instance, Jennifer Pan, one of my co-authors on the Science Advances piece that we're talking about today, has studied the arrest of Saudi bloggers and the impact of those arrests on their audience behavior. So it can be the use of traditional repressive tools, but targeting people because of their activity online. Or it could be also the use of digital tools to engage in repression. So there you're thinking about things like filtering what people can get access to online, using online surveillance to understand networks of people or who's trying to access information, but it can also involve information channeling, which operates by not trying to control or limit access to information, as, for instance, traditional censorship has done, but instead to distract people or to provide them with misinformation or disinformation. So in China, for instance, an example of information channeling that's really about distraction would be posts from the 50 Cent Army, which is basically fee for post posters who post online to cheerlead the Chinese state and sort of distract from political issues that the Chinese state doesn't want people paying attention to. But then it would also include more covert forms of information channeling, like disinformation. So a disinformation campaign really depends on the fact that at least some people will believe it, so that it is false or fake, is hidden. And we're seeing those kinds of campaigns in really clear resolution in Russia right now.
With grants from institutions like the National Science Foundation, you worked through the history of protests since the 1960s, when it was common for police to use beatings, tear gas, and just arrest the protesters. And in the 1900s, government and business refused to hire or fired communists and gays and people of color. Tell us about the social study of repression before the online world emerged.
Certainly. Unfortunately, you're exactly right. As long as people have been challenging authorities, authorities have been challenging them and trying to limit, repress, prevent, curtail, or stop their activities. So that falls under the broad umbrella of the study of social movement repression, where we're really specifically interested in not sort of general controls of whole populations, but particularly the control of protest. And classically, we've thought about some of the same kinds of dimensions that we can use to think about digital protest. So we've thought about, for instance, differences between the types of actors who engage in repression. And in the examples you just gave me, you mentioned private companies, which is certainly private actors have traditionally and continuing to today, and including using digital tools, tried to repress, but also national governments. So you made reference to like the FBI's COINTELPRO program. But then state and local governments have also, and police forces have also tried to repress protest across time. So we've traditionally tried to understand two things about repression, whether it's being done by state or private actors, which is what leads repressors to engage in repression, and then what are the consequences of repression. And it's really interesting because the literature has an incredible amount of agreement about what leads to at least traditional forms of repression. And one of the questions that arises with digital repression is whether or not there will be such a high level of consensus about what leads to digital repression. But for traditional forms of repression, the literature really focuses on the more threatening a protest movement is to a particular actor, whether that actor is state or private, the more likely that actor is to try to repress. And threats can exist for a wide variety of reasons. They can exist because you have large numbers of people involved in your movement. They could exist, some people call what I'm about to tell you, the mismatch hypothesis, that your movement is strong, for instance, in a territory where the state is weak. And so even though your movement may not be a national movement, because it has strength where the state doesn't, it'll be threatening. In the United States, I've looked at what kinds of things are threatening to police officers. That is, what kinds of things do police officers perceive as threats to themselves? For instance, it's quite common to find that the presence of counter-demonstrators, which produces real conflict at protesters, creates a heightened sense of threat for police officers, but also the use of particular kinds of tactics. On the other hand, we've also studied what's the consequences of repression. And there, the literature has almost no consensus. It turns out that you could give me almost any hypothesis you want about what repression will do to individual protesters, the movements they represent, or the broader public, and I can find you a study that will support it. So if you want to think that repression successfully deters protest or future protest, I can find a study that'll support it. If you want to say, no, it backfires and it actually gets individual protesters to double down and radicalize or brings bystanders into a movement, I can find a study that'll show that. We could talk about, you know, tons of other explanations or expected relationships that people have had, and it turns out it's a really indeterminate relationship. So I think one of the big surprises for people when they learn more about the study of social movement repression is that it's a real gamble for authorities, that we think about, you know, oh, if people are going to repress, that's automatically going to be effective for them. But that's not at all what the literature shows.
Well, that could be interesting. When we take the case of the Russian government, they just made a law threatening up to 15 years in jail for calling an invasion, and that's public and overt, and it's meant to be. But there are also some covert control mechanisms that governments are taking in the digital age. Could you tell us about a couple of those?
So one of the big uses of digital tools for covert purposes is for various kinds of surveillance. And that surveillance happens, an important point we make in this Science Advances piece, is that that surveillance happens in democratic and more authoritarian nations. And so oftentimes people think about repression as being something that autocrats have a monopoly on. But unfortunately, historically and today, that's not true. Democratic regimes and authoritarian regimes both use repressive tools and often draw from sort of similar repertoires, even if the extent, amount, severity of that repression may differ between democracies and autocracies. So digital surveillance certainly happens. Local police in the United States use things like sting raids to try to listen into and intercept cell phone conversations. Some nations use their own custom-built platform surveillance tools. Others buy those tools actually from private companies who sell them that allow the state to monitor what kinds of requests people are making, to block requests, to filter material, or even to just rate limit it so that it's sort of throttled. You can't get as much. And that can be an important source of information about dissent, both who's dissenting and what they're dissenting about when used for surveillance. But then once you go into the actual obstruction of that information, you're talking about a different form of repression. So when we go to actual throttling, when we go to actual filtering, we're talking more about information control forms. And we're certainly seeing that in Russia. We see it in China. We see it in a variety of nations where there are various obvious but oftentimes covert forms of information control that are put into place so that you just can't get some things. And then, of course, there's what we were talking about before, efforts where you don't try to completely eliminate the ability to access information, because let's face it, that's hard to do online. But instead, you try to distract most people away from the information that you don't want them to notice. One way to think about this is you sort of weaponize the information overload of the internet. Things may be out there that as a government you don't want people to see, and so it turns out it's really hard to entirely remove people's access to see that. And so many nations now use some form of what Citizen Lab's Ron Deibert called active engagement, where you try to distract people away from the information that you don't want to see by entertainment-related posts, government cheerleading, or by disinformation.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest sociology professor and researcher Jennifer Earle. We are discussing the new paper that she led. It's titled The Digital Repression of Social Movements, Protest, and Activism, A Synthetic Review. Well, Jennifer, I'm also concerned, and I know you are too, from the paper, that with all the tools available like YouTube and TikTok and so on, it's a mistake to just focus on repression by big governments. I mean, even individuals can get involved in this.
Absolutely. One of the points that we make in reviewing the literature is exactly how important private repressors are to understanding the overall landscape of repression around the globe. And introducing private actors introduces a great deal of complexity into that situation because private actors get involved in repression for a wide variety of reasons. So some of those reasons may have to do with pressure that they themselves face from governments that are regulating them or allowing them into their country. So, for instance, the regulations that you see Russia putting on platforms right now are a big part of the reason that platforms like TikTok have stopped allowing uploads from Russia in order to comply with this new Russian law. And China has a kind of different relationship with media that has allowed, they've kept media companies more domestic in China, which allows them to have the Chinese government to really, even though they're private companies, to apply a lot of pressure to those companies. But then you have companies who are engaged in repression purely for their own motives, which may be profit-driven or otherwise. Sometimes these are very short-term ventures. So, for instance, there is evidence of Facebook getting rid of accounts related to protesters before particular financial transactions that would benefit Facebook were going to take place to sort of clean up Facebook to make it look more attractive to investors. But sometimes those repressive activities are much more part and parcel to the overall profit motives of that company. And as you pointed out, individuals can get into this game too. So a very serious issue right now is online harassment of protesters. That can be done in a collaborative way, but it can also be individuals acting on their own who are using the availability of information about people online to target other individuals and attack them or harass them for their political engagement.
Companies like Google, Facebook, and Twitter say they are neutral, just selling advertising. But I think one shocking realization from your study, the Internet is not really a free speech zone at all. What is the reality when private companies control so much of the public conversation?
I'm so glad that you raised this point because I think it's something that many people don't realize. So in the United States, where we think about ourselves as having free assembly and free speech rights, those are actually really controlled by a legal set of doctrines called public forum law. And they basically say that depending on where you're standing, you have different kinds of rights. So if I go to a private property, I don't actually have any free speech or assembly rights. I can be asked to be quiet or to leave by the people who own that property. And then even if what I want to say is politically motivated and about politics, I can be charged with trespass or other things if I stay. My free speech rights really come into play when I am on public grounds, like if I'm in a park or on a sidewalk, and to a more limited extent in some kinds of public use, publicly owned buildings. One thing that had been noted before the rise of digital activism, the pervasive use of digital tools for activism, was that already in the United States, audience was sort of shifting from these kinds of large public venues, parks, sidewalks, busy city streets, to much more privatized settings like ballparks, privately owned parks, suburban neighborhoods. And this was already creating problems for protesters and gaining audience. So two sociologists, John McCarthy and Clark McPhail, wrote about this and basically said protesters were in a real bind because they were having to choose between having a big audience, but not having the same protections that they would have to gain that audience by going into private spaces like malls, sports arenas, et cetera. Or they could go to those parks and use those sidewalks where they did have free speech rights, but they wouldn't have nearly as large of audiences. Online, that situation is even worse because we do not have an equivalent of a public park. We do not have an equivalent of a public access public building. We do not have the equivalent of a public sidewalk. We have privately owned servers, which means that the kinds of free speech and assembly rights that we think about ourselves enjoying are not rights that unproblematically transfer into digital spaces. And so when we think we're speaking, quote unquote, freely on Facebook, posting pictures through Instagram, on TikTok, we really are effectively speaking in private spaces, which means that those companies have the ability to limit, to kick people off, to otherwise influence what can be on their platforms. And that is a really concerning turn because there are not public alternatives.
I post video interviews about extreme climate change on YouTube, but if you search climate change there, you're far, far more likely to get anti-science rants by Alex Jones than Alex Smith. Controversy sells, even when it's dangerous. Do you think algorithms are set really to work against the truth in some cases?
Oh, this has been such a big issue with YouTube and Facebook. And to some extent what surfaces on Google in higher-level search results, like first-page results, those algorithms are the sort of secret sauces of those companies, and they're very protective about them. And there does seem to be indication, for instance, from leaked documents from the Facebook whistleblower who was a Facebook employee and then took a tranche of documents and has made them public, there does seem to be really good evidence that companies like Facebook understand that what their algorithms are doing are not pro-social or pro-democratic, but they're profitable. And that puts many, many nations in, not just the U.S. for sure, in a very difficult position. Because you have companies that are so influential as spaces in what people can gain ready access to learn about, and yet what's being delivered to you isn't necessarily a reflection of what's true, what's most trusted. Those algorithms, as you suggested, are built to deliver for those companies. And whether or not we can see those companies change for themselves versus governments having to force them to change remains to be a very open question.
Jennifer, what about cases where the majority of citizens want digital repression, like bans on child pornography?
Well, as repression researchers, we wouldn't really consider a ban on child pornography to be social movement repression because there's not really a social movement, an attempt for change that is getting harassed or limited through those bans. So I do want to make a distinction between governance and repression. While it is the case that both of them control things, repression is control that is attempting to stop social movements and political expression. So I think we're always going to have governance. And there is an incredible amount of research about the ways in which governance can be racialized or serve class interests or otherwise be unequal. But we do want to separate those kind governance broadly from the study of social movement repression more specifically.
Almost 20 years ago, you published the paper Tanks, Tear Gas, and Taxes Towards a Theory of Movement Repression. Well, the tanks may have been replaced by shadow banning, but do you think social movements can continue as a force for good in the digital age?
Absolutely. I think one of the most important messages from the literature on social movement repression is that it doesn't always work. And people and the movements that they represent have shown just a tremendous resilience to keep pressing for change, to be resilient to attempts to quash movements. And while sometimes repression does work and you do see movements that go away or people who leave activism because of it, it's just not the case that repression is a silver bullet for authority holders, power holders, to deal with democratic expression and protest. The second thing I'll say there is that one of the other large shifts that social movement scholars have documented over the last 30 to 40 years is the rise of what social movement scholars call social movement societies. And the basic idea of a social movement society is that in countries like the U.S., Canada, many Western European nations, protest has become such a regular part of political participation that it's really hard to think about political participation in sort of old school ways of just about voting. That really social movements and the persistence of people engaging in social movements has transformed what it even means to be political in a way that includes activism. So I think that it is absolutely true that repressors have for a very long time tried to stop protest and will continue to do so into the future and will continue to adopt new tools, expand existing tools, as we see with digital repression. But it is also true that activists will use some of those tools to forward their own causes. Some of those activists and some of those movements will be resilient and sometimes even grow as a result of repression as repression backfires.
Jennifer, your website contains many tools for online activists to learn more about this playing space. You even offer a free spreadsheet bibliography of resources. What is your aim?
I believe that people should have a voice. I think it's really important for people to engage politically. I think it's important for people to press for power holders in their lives, whether those are companies or governments, to be more responsive to them. My aim is to try to help people understand how they can do that and how they can do that more effectively, what the risks they may face when they do that are, and to try to understand how to manage some of those risks.
And as we wrap up here, what are the next big questions you hope to answer?
Well, I think that a really pressing issue facing a wide variety of scholars, including digital repression scholars and repression scholars more generally, are about the dynamics of disinformation and polarization. I think one of the things that we're seeing clearly both in Russia and in the United States, and the comparison actually maybe helps, is that you don't have to be able to censor information to be able to spread a great deal of disinformation, as long as people are willing to be distrustful of legitimate information that they're getting. Put differently, you could look at the new censorship law that Russia passed that you mentioned earlier that makes it a crime to refer to the invasion as an invasion or war. And you could think that's such a high level of censorship, and it is. But even if people keep talking about the invasion and the war, if they're talking to people who just don't believe that that's true, that it's fake news, and there are reports of people in the Ukraine calling their Russian parents or Russian relatives and talking to them about the war, and those relatives saying, what are you talking about? This is a special military operation. There's no war, and we're helping you save your country because it's being taken over by Nazis. Those people, it's not that they just don't have access to information. You could give them lots of information about the war, and they're not believing it. In the United States, where we don't have the same kinds of information controls, we're still finding that people are very willing to, some people are willing to believe disinformation. And when it gets promoted and repeated from sources that they trust, belief in it can grow. And, you know, now you have surveys of the Republican Party showing that substantial percentages of Republican Party members don't believe that Biden probably won the U.S. election. And what that tells us is we're sort of past a moment where censorship is what prevents people from knowing the truth. Now we're at a place where also distrust can prevent people from knowing the truth. And those are very different information dynamics that I think we'll be trying to understand the full impact and dimensions of for some time to come.
From the University of Arizona, we've been speaking with Dr. Jennifer Earle, professor of sociology. Her years of published papers are a goldmine for activists, whether online or on the streets. Find links you need in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Jennifer, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. This was a real pleasure.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.